Toby, that's not.
Has joined.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing, Malka? Is it still raining in Texas?
No, we haven't had any rain yet today.
Oh, you sent it all over here to us.
Oh, really? Sorry about that. It's a blessing.
Yes, it is a blessing. There's no question about it. But we are having a discussion about whether you can say Kiddush in the sukkah if it is raining. And on the first night, you are supposed to do that, whether it's raining or not. But then the question was asked whether you could say the Kiddush early. And the one answer was, no, you cannot, because you're thinking strictly of the Shabbat Kiddush. And that may have been appropriate to the consciousness of the person asking the question. But the question as phrased is, can you do Kiddush early? Every time you pray, which means mincha, which is supposed to be done at noon or 1 o'clock or as early in the afternoon as possible, after every prayer, you are able to do Kiddush. The big mincha or the small mincha? Which is which? With that in mind, our class today is I'm not sure which link it is on the Advanced Reincarnation landing page. I believe it's 6D. It may be 6E. But it starts with Chapter 4, Section 1, titled When the Second Gilgul is Like the First. And I haven't said the L'shem Yehud, so we will start with that. And we will then continue the conversation after the class about the Kiddush and what you meant. L'shem Yichud Kudcha Berichu Ishkinte Bidhilu Urchimu Udkilu Udkilu Urchimu Le'akta L'shem Yudhe Bavate V'yichuda Shalim B'shem Kol Yisrael Limud Torah Mitzvah La'asok Torah Mitzvah Vayhino Amadunai Luhinu Elena Maseya Denu Kunane Elena Maseya Denu Kunanehu. When the second Gilgul is like the first, do I need to remind everybody what's the difference between a second Gilgul or a first Gilgul? You need the reminder? There's a head shaking yes, so I will give you the reminder. Gilgul means a wheel. Reincarnation is a series of cycles called lifetimes. The first incarnation, you are capable of achieving the totality of the tikkun, which is 125 levels. They are the five levels called Arikantin, Abba, Ima, Zerantin, and Malchut, or Nok. Those are words for Partsufim. A Partsuf, which translates as a face, is a structure of 10 sephirot. From Keter to Malchut, there are 10 Sephirot. You have those five levels of tikkunim for the level of nefesh, the lowest level of the soul. Then you have the another five for the level of the ruach, and the third five for the level of the neshama. Five times five times five is 125 levels. When your first incarnation, that is your total tikkun, 125 levels. You are capable of achieving that in 1 year, but nobody does that. You are also capable of achieving it in that first lifetime. Very few people achieve that. When you do not complete your 125 levels in that first lifetime, there is a different set of rules for the wheels for the next incarnation and those afterwards. That set of rules is changed primarily with the idea that the nefesh cannot come with the ruach of that same soul. So if you complete, Malka, are you hearing any static? Because I am a little bit.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Are you hearing me fine?
Yes, I'm going to go mute just in case it's me.
No, are you driving?
No, sir, I'm outside looking at the circle that I'm trying to put together here.
So that's what I'm hearing is that background noise. Like, it's not noise, but that background actions of building the circle.
All right, I'm good.
As you mute it, you'll still be able to hear me, and we won't be able to hear your noise. Excuse my expression, noise. It's not meant to be noise. It's a mitzvah. Thank you. So back to the discussion. So we have a second Gilgulim, a second lifetime. If in the first lifetime you completed all five levels of the nefesh, then that nefesh is now complete, but it cannot come into that lifetime, the second lifetime, or any of the future lifetimes with that ruach. The ruach must attach itself to something called a ger, a stranger, a convert. Is both translations, stranger and convert, is appropriate. So the ruach comes into the second lifetime with a strange nefesh. The actions of the nefesh. Excuse me one second. The actions of the, that I know, but I think I meant to say the actions of the nefesh coming into that second lifetime is whatever actions that body-soul combination does will add to the merit of that stranger nefesh, but it will not detract from it if the actions are a sin. That's primarily the difference. So nefesh is not the nefesh that was the original soul, nefesh, ruach, and neshama. Now, what we are about to talk about in chapter 4, section 1, when is the second Gilgul like the first? Meaning, when can it attach itself to the original Nefesh? Am I clear? In this section, we will learn another way that all three levels of the soul, the Nefesh, the Ruach, and the Neshama, may be received in one lifetime, even though it is not his first Gilgul. There are two other distinctions that apply only to the Gilgulim. They apply only to the Gilgulim and not to the Ibur or the Yibum. The Ibur means a pregnant soul. But the Ibur means a soul that comes into the body at a time other than birth. Or a spark of that soul, a part of that soul that comes into the body at a time other than birth. That's the meaning of Ibur. The purpose of that happening is for the Ibur level of soul to borrow the body to do a mitzvah that soul needs to do to complete his tikkun. And to help the original soul that's a Gilgul that came into the body at birth to achieve a mitzvah that it finds difficult to do. Typically, that is referring to the wasting of seed. So the Ibur will come into the body sometime after birth, even sometime after puberty, and then will help argue with the good, along with the good inclination, to stop doing the wasting of seed. That's one example. But there are many other examples of why an Ibur comes into that body. And there's a whole discussion of what happens on Friday night. Friday night, and also on second meal of Shabbat and third meal of Shabbat, the food that is brought to a table of a Kabbalist or a student of Kabbalah may very well happen, and it's typically the soul that was originally in the fish, because the fish is always in water, and therefore the soul is never exposed. That human soul living in the fish is never exposed to sins, because it's always surrounded by chesed, which is water. But when that fish is eaten by the human being who's studying Kabbalah, that soul goes into the human being. And by being in the human being, it acts as an Ibur. Now, that soul has completed, an Ibur of a Tzaddik has completed its tikkun. It's only coming to help or to finalize some mitzvah that it has not completed. That soul comes into the body, but it can only elevate to heaven in certain months of the year. Or it can only elevate from the fish to the human in certain months of the year. But it may not be that mitzvah that it needs to do will only happen in one of the months that it cannot elevate. So it sits in the body and helps that body achieve its tikkun. Then when that action of help is no longer needed, the the person, the soul of the fish, the human soul that was in the fish, that's now in the human being, is elevated to its home in Garden of Eden. Yes, Toby. How much does a soul weigh, Toby? I'll give you a hint. Scientifically, they measured. They put a body that was about to die on a bed that was a scale. And they measured before death and after death. It's 2 ounces, the weight of a soul. Now, the 2 ounces, can it be in a sliver of a fish?
Yeah.
Of course it can. There's no dimension to spirituality. There's no width, height, or length. Although those terms are used in the language of branches. Now, do you know what the language of branches are? No. Language of branches is the language of Kabbalah that uses everyday terms that everybody knows what they mean. They're physical terms, but they're not discussing anything physical. They're discussing everything in the physical world is a branch that parallel is its root. So when you say grass, everybody knows what grass is. There's blue grass and there's green grass and there's different species of grass. But if I say the word grass, everybody knows what grass is. But I'm not talking about the grass in the physical world. I'm talking about ground cover. But what does ground cover mean in a spiritual frame of reference? That's the language of branches. That's the language of Kabbalah. And you can see and understand how confusing it has become over the centuries. When the sages say grass, what are they talking about? They're not talking about the physical grass, but a lot of people interpret it as physical grass. It's not a stupid question. Yes, I can attest to that because I had a neighbor that I played football with from the age of about 8 to 15, that until he was 12, he was eating grass. It gave him attention. Because he had a dysfunctional family and he needed certain attention. Well, what? He never made a blessing. He was living in a dysfunctional family. Absolutely not. I never met his family. We used to make fun of the kid for eating grass. So, but as I aged, like last week, it came to me. Just as you asked the question, it came to me. No. But we did ask him, what does it taste like? And he said, grass. You can interpret that he was trying to cajole us. But that was his children. And children do lots of strange things. to get attention. So getting back to the idea of the fish, every fish that you partake in on Shabbat, according to the Kabbalah and the Kabbalists, more than likely has a soul of a tzaddik within it. And the reason you're eating it is to elevate it. And in the Kabbalistic custom, and minhag, I don't know what the Ashkenazi or the Sephardi is, after you eat fish, but before you partake of any other parts of the meal, you have l'chaim. You have a little bit of alcoholic beverage to elevate the soul of that tzaddik and settle him into your body. You never heard what before? Having l'chaim? Well, you just never had the first meal with a chabadnik. Which is usually some form of fish. And then you proceed to get drunk. Not with a little bit. I said you've never been to a chabadnik first meal. No. For chabadniks, every Shabbat is Purim. And I'm not... It depends on which Chabad house you're talking about.
I knew there was always time, and you know, being from
Kentucky bourbon in Louisville is much less expensive than brandy. So I'm sure it was Kentucky bourbon.
And you were Spanish as what?
I would have specified wine. Schnapps is not wine. And you cannot get drunk on wine if you add the 3 drops of water to each bottle. Three drops only, and only to the bottle. And when I first came here, that's what I was still doing. I would come late, and I didn't have time. And nobody really knew, and we don't drink enough to get drunk, so why do it? But there's another Kabbalistic reason why you add 3 drops of water to the wine. Wine is a left column product. That's why it elevates. You get drunk, meaning you've elevated. But you also...
Elevate. No,
you've elevated the human soul. A glass of wine. Yeah, she's hearing all of it. She's loving it. It's not an issue. That's why do you think people come to my classes on wine? Because they get to listen to this stuff. Because people ask these kinds of questions. Wine is a left column entity, essence, meaning it's going to elevate the soul, its desire. That's why you get high with wine. When you add water, which is right column, you're creating balance between the left and right columns. Balance meaning the middle column, the central point. So you don't want to allow yourself to get drunk. So you bring that column energy over to the middle. The basic essence of water is
has joined.
So, are we ready to go on with the class, or we still want to stay with this material? Because you're getting a lot of information that's coming. All from which is an indication of what's going on. That's why I asked her about the rain. Louisiana. It's not even a lot of rain. Or 4 inches in an hour. And the roofs have been blown off by the hurricane. So the rain now is in the house. And it's from the cold. And, you know, how do you build it? Take everything out of the house. And if it moves back, it'll do to take it back in the house. And if you do that, that's the thing. In Israel, the purpose of the, what's it called? Terrace of a house.
When a house is,
has joined.
Welcome back. Hopefully the call won't drop this time. But so, it's a whole process. And it's really, there's a lot of chaos in that part of the country because of it. But let us start at least to hopefully finish this section. So as we got to this point where I said, do you know what an ibur is, meaning a pregnant soul, the stranger? But the other aspect is a yibum. The yibum is the soul who died without having children. In order for that soul to be brought back into being it reincarnated, it requires that the brother or the closest relative, male relative, marries the widow, and that child will be the soul of that person who died. So she is no longer married to that person. She is his mother. And that creates a lot of relationship issues. Firstly, the things that apply to this issue. If a first-time Gilgul earns his nefesh, his ruach and his neshama, and then sins and blemishes them, in his next reincarnation, he cannot rectify them all at once, except through the device that was explained beforehand, the saying of a particular verse prior to sleep. We discussed this, which is part of the nighttime Shema ritual. When going to bed, he should recite the verse, "My nefesh has desired you at night." And I did look up what the verse number was. I don't remember what it is. And this was explained at the end of last chapter 3. The two distinctions mentioned here are made possible by entirely different circumstances that are possible by possible depending upon what happened during the first Gilgul. Either he earned all of his Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama during the first Gilgul before he sinned, as in the first possibility that we have just read, or he earned only his Nefesh before he sinned in the first Gilgul, which is the second possibility that will be explained here. In the first possibility, he cannot receive all of his Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama in his second Gilgul except through the device of reciting the verse. My Nefesh has desired you at night, as was explained at the end of the last chapter. Then his Nefesh will remain above in the supernal well, and in the morning his Ruach will come down in its place. Now the rabbi will explain the second possible way of achieving all the Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama in a second Gilgul. So what we've described is a person completed his tikkun, but why is he still alive? Because he has not brought children that he needs to bring. So that's why he will have achieved it. Then he's not going to complete his tikkun. He can't complete his tikkun. But in that case, if he completed all that he could do in that lifetime, he will pass. As soon as your tikkun is complete, there's no reason to be in the world, except there are women who stay beyond the lifetime of their soulmate, and there are certain men that need to bring additional children. Because the whole understanding of DNA and genes and chromosomes, which science is developing, is very much part of the system that it serves a purpose of spreading characteristics, because in your DNA are personality traits as well. It's not a personality trait that says this is what you will be. It's a personality that says you have this tendency to do good, and you have this tendency to do not good. Well, you inherit a predilection to it, but you have free will to an extent, but not really, because the nurture is part of that system. The nurture being, what is the values you are raised with as a child? So that's all part of the plan of that lifetime. So there is no such thing as free will except for one decision, and that's to stop your reactive behavior, which we call binding by striking. Zavug za'aka'a is the Hebrew or the Aramaic. It means binding by striking. You have to fight against Satan, your evil inclination, to stop your reactions. We've all had the experience throughout our lifetime at one time or another. We had an incident happen, and we should have gotten angry. Our reaction was to get angry. I'm using this as an example. We get angry. Some of us stop that anger. Others let it go through. But all of that is built into the what's known, what Hashem sees you will do in this lifetime. So everything is known to Hashem, but it's not known to us. And I can see what's wrong or what's the issue for another human being, not just me. Anybody will have some insights as to what somebody should do, and they'll come to a friend and ask for advice. The friend gives them advice. But if it's your tikkun, you will have no insights. You can go to a friend and ask for that insight. Ask them to tell you what you should do. But that's your free will. Will you stop your reactions? I reacted. I did something horrible. I hurt someone. I yelled at my 12-year-old daughter. She was devastated because she had only heard me yell one time. My father spanked me one time in my life because the value he wanted me to express as a 12, as a 13-year-old, was he wanted me to go with him to a family event. And I wanted nothing to do with that family event. I got spanked so that I would go. It was a very devastating, traumatic event because it was the only time he ever spanked me. Now, what, was there free choice? No, but it was about learning the value of family from his perspective. Did I accept his perspective? Did I teach that perspective to my children? I changed the perspective. No. His perspective was valid for him. But as a parent, he's saying what's valid for me is valid for each of my children. There are very few parents who realize that each child has a different personality. And if you realize that each child has a different personality, each child has a different tikkun, and you're given that information as a parent, this is the tikkun of this child, and this is a different tikkun for that child, they're going to need to be treated differently. But you're definitely going to get the sibling rivalry that his piece of cake is bigger than mine. Well, that's what's implied by the statement. A 4-year-old makes that statement. He's not strong enough yet to say, you love him more than me. But that's what he's really saying. So the reason that the nefesh that's been rectified cannot come back with a ruach that's not yet rectified is it's asking the question, how can a rectified nefesh become the vehicle for a damaged ruach or a damaged neshama? And this is not the case when they have all come together and have all become blemished together. For how can a rectified nefesh become the vehicle for a damaged ruach or neshama? However, if he only damaged the nefesh, then all three can return together in a single gilgul. For the first Gilgul, the Nefesh does not rectify completely. There may be a second Gilgul just with that Nefesh. The Nefesh does now completely rectify in the second Gilgul. The Ruach comes. Sin happens. There will be a second Gilgul with the nephesh from a ger. The ger is completely rectified, and that nephesh of that ger never gets hurt by the sin. Only the ruach who did the sin gets. But the purpose of that ger is to support, be the horse for the rider of the ruach. This last paragraph, the nefesh, the ruach, and the neshama is received. Then there is a sin. The neshama is affected by the sin. The rectification may happen in that first gilgul, along with possible saying of the prayer as above. Let me give you a perspective. We all have been taught, and not everybody who will hear the recording will have been taught, so I'm going to give some background to this. But we all have been taught that when you die, there's a judgment of what did you accomplish in this lifetime. But that it's really not a judgment of what did you accomplish in this lifetime vis-a-vis your tikkun. That's already known. What's the judgment after you die is what should happen to you. Are you going to reincarnate? Or can you become an ibur for the one thing that you need to fix? Or do you have to go to Gehinnom and be cleansed there and then go to the Garden of Eden and not have to reincarnate? That's the purpose of that final judgment. Every night, the Bet Din, the court, is meeting to evaluate where you are today. What did you do today vis-a-vis this year's corrections? Because you have 190 years of life. What have you accomplished? What do you have left to accomplish? How do we arrange the meetings of the souls involved to effect, give you the both the opportunity to make that tikkun? The toe you stepped on in the darkened theater as you crawled over people to get to the middle. How did they arrange that soul to be there so that you could step on their toe? Because that's what you had to do to make correction with that soul. That is taking place every night. The Bet Dins of every night is not Hashem, it's the Tzaddikim. And it may be a living Tzaddik as well. He may participate as part of the Bet Din, or it may be someone that's dead, but it's someone who has the understanding of what it means to be human and to make these mistakes, and also has the understanding of what it takes to complete and not make the mistake. So the court takes place with Satan saying, here is the plan that I have for him for tomorrow. In this plan, which is based on harsh judgment, this is what should happen. The Bet Din interjects, asks for witnesses to ameliorate that harsh judgment, and sometimes it gets sweetened and sometimes it doesn't. But that takes place every night. If you say the particular verse that we've talked about, and if you have completed a level of the ruach in a certain part of your body. For example, the tikkun was to not steal an apple from a particular farmer's tree. But you walked up to the apple. But I didn't steal it this time. I still, the fact that I walked up to it is harming the ruach level of my soul, of my feet, of my legs. So they have to arrange the level that, okay, I didn't do it. So that part of my body, the arm, has completed its tikkun. It will stay up there, and I'll have a new soul part that comes into the arm. But the legs' soul parts will have to come back. That's what the judgment is. That's the questions that are raised. In the given year, on Rosh Hashanah and through the 10 days, what's sealed on Yom Kippur is, what are you going to accomplish in this year? What's the tikkun in all the different soul parts? That's the completion of this section. And it's about 10 minutes to 5, so it gives you an idea where we were. But it wasn't a logical discussion. We didn't follow step by step, but we didn't need to, did we? Are there any questions on the conference call, Martha? Or if anybody else arrived?
Question is, when we put the lulav together, do we do that inside the sukkah, and do we need to say the blessing before we go into sukkah, even though we're still preparing?
The answer to it is you say the blessing about sitting in the sukkah when you sit down to eat. That's the blessing that you say for eating. We're sitting in the sukkah. The blessing with respect to the lulav, you can prepare it outside of the sukkah or inside of the sukkah. It would be better prepared inside the sukkah if the weather permits, and if you have your sukkah sufficiently developed that you have a table and chair that you can do it there and it's comfortable. Otherwise, go ahead and prepare it outside the sukkah. Is that clear, or is it you need some additional clarity?
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. You have a beautiful Chag Sameach.
You too.
And always remember, the purpose of Sukkot is to express joy and to receive joy.
Right.
So anything that crosses that line, that's going to, God forbid, take you away from the level of joy, disregard it and avoid it. You cannot avoid the action. You can only avoid how you respond to the reaction. Chag Sameach.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.